Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another session of the Londoner. This is the second of two sessions on Marxism. It's a very important world ideology, so we actually dedicated two sessions to it. The first one was more explanatory in scope, and this one is going to be more discussion based. And we have with us, in fact, to start this discussion, no other than the chair of the Communist Party of Great Britain, Jack Conrad. How are you, Jack Conrad?
I'm very well, thank you. Surviving COVID so far.
Excellent. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more how to survive more than just COVID. but we're going to ask some questions, and Jack, we wanted to get it from you, obviously firsthand. You've written about communism yourself. You're the author of a book called Fantastic Reality, which I'm sure is freely available online. And you're also, as we mentioned, you're the leader of the Communist Party of Great Britain. So you have expertise both on the ground and in written works. First question, a very simple question, which is, how would you define Marxism, and how would you explain its implications, if it were to be implemented, on a political, social, and economic level?
Okay. Well, I would define Marxism as a theory and practice of human liberation. Marxism is rooted deep in philosophy, not least German philosophy, but also in classic philosophy, so dialectics, but also, you know, historical materialism, so the study of history, the attempt to grasp historic laws. You could say Marxism is also about economics, but Marx, I think, would have objected to that. He would call himself a critic of economics, but also it's about politics. And in terms of what would be the result would be, first of all, the overthrow of capitalism, the constitution of the working class as the ruling class, but crucially using a semi-state that withers away. So Marxism is actually about ending class of all sorts, ending exploitation, ending the antagonism between human beings and nature, and it's actually about a project of rounded individual development. So we're not anti-individual, we're in favour of the fullest possible individual development, but that's reliant on collectivity. In other words, we don't see the individual outside society. So that's my couple of minutes definition of Marxism.
Okay. And the second question I want to ask you is the overlaps you see, since you've written about religion and politics, so you kind of delved into both spheres. What are the overlaps you see between Marxism and Islam in particular? Obviously, we should caveat this by saying that Marxism can be interpreted in a variety of different ways, as Islam can be as well. But generally speaking, how would you rate or analyze or assess the overlaps between Marxism and Islam?
Well, first of all, I'd say with Islam, but all the Abrahamic religions, there's this idea of achieving a better world. Sometimes, certainly when it comes to Christianity, I have to excuse myself, I was brought up a Christian, so I know a little bit more about that. There is the idea, oh well, the better world is there for heaven when we're dead. But I think in all three major religions, there is this idea of a better world here and now. I'd also say that as chair of the Communist Party, while we are guided by Marxism, we have no bar on people being religious. And indeed, in our own organization, we've not only got people from a religious background. I mean, we've had in our ranks, for example, a Church of England vicar. So we are guided by Marxism, but as a party, we would seek to recruit all people, no matter what their background, because an awful lot of people, whether they are religious or non-religious, want a better world. So that's the overlap. It's about the world that we're living in and the world that that we all want.
Mm. Before I continue asking questions, I just wanted to ask the participants here if they have any probing or follow-up questions or any comments they wanted to make so far, just to involve everyone in the room. Is there any comments or questions that anyone has for Jack Conrad?
I mean, I was just thinking that in terms of the Muslim world in the 20th century, we've had sort of leftist parties. So the Ba'ath Party in Iraq and Syria would claim themselves to be parties of maybe not communism as such and Marxism as such, but at least the left-leaning parties. And the experience that Muslims have had with that are very strong secular states, this sort of demonization of the practice of faith. So how can you then say that there is this sort of overlap between Islam specifically, I'm not talking general Abrahamic religion, but Islam and Marxism or communism or socialism? And I'm not even talking about communist states, I'm talking about leftist states. Let's not even go to places like Albania, Russia, and what happened to Muslims there.
I'm not sure if you heard that, Jack.
I did.
Excellent,
did.
Perfect, so I don't have to repeat.
I might have missed a couple of words, but I've got the gist of it.
Yeah, perfect.
And, yes, you're absolutely right, my friend, that in terms of the record of those that call themselves secularists, and certainly I'm well aware in terms of the record of those that call themselves communists, it's often been more than disgraceful. So you mentioned Albania, an atheist state. Jesus, sorry about my background coming out. The Soviet Union, I mean, to me, when they began a war on religion, that was a deviation from Marxism. And okay, you could trace that back to something like the mid-20s, maybe even earlier, but it became its most extreme in the East against Muslims. So the forced unveiling of women, for example, was hotly contested in the leadership of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. We know who won. And precisely this gets back to, you know, your original observation, Mohammed, you know, that there are many different sorts, you know, of people that describe themselves as Muslims, and there are many sorts of people who describe themselves as communists. All I would say is that in terms of orthodox Marxism, the idea of war, the persecution of religious people because of their religion, is absolutely abhorrent. What we stand for is the right to practice one's religion, full stop. And as long as that doesn't harm other people, we find that perfectly acceptable. So any state that starts to persecute people because of their religion, in my view, is anti-secular and certainly anti-communist. So in my analysis, Stalin Soviet Union is what I call a counter-revolution within the revolution. It turns against the people, it turns against the working class. The working class in the Soviet Union was exploited. So, yeah, I'm not going to apologize for that. I'm going to fight that because to me, you know, these people who call themselves communists are actually anti-communist and have discredited the name of communism and Marxism because of their criminal actions.
Right. Is there any other questions for Jack on this point here? Yeah.
Just to come back on that point. So in logic, you have this idea of what's called the no true Scotsman fallacy, that when someone points out that there's a problem, for example, the Marxist state, you say, oh, well, those are not true examples of Marxism. There is no real Scotsman. So can you then give us an example of Marxism on a state level in practice, not just what Marxism itself, but also this what you've said is the freedom for people to practice their religion according to their own beliefs within a Marxist state? Can you give us an example of that specifically?
Well, no. Full stop. Why? Because the Marxist project was envisaged, you could say rightly or wrongly, but the Marxist project was envisaged on the working class taking over in countries where the working class was the majority and winning what Marx called the battle for democracy. And therefore, when we look at so-called Marxist states, I mean, the only one I can point to that had a glimmer of a beginning, but it couldn't go anywhere, is the Russian Revolution of 1917. But from a Marxist point of view, we shouldn't have expected it to survive in isolation. It survives in isolation, but turns into its opposite. So the Marxist program is actually about the working class coming to power in the advanced capitalist countries. Nowadays, Europe, Western Europe, North America, Japan, they're crucial to our project. And without them, we don't expect anything other than what I would call freak societies, pretense, horrors. And that's what's produced. So, no, I can't. That's the honest answer. But we shouldn't, in terms of a Marxist point of view, expect anything else. How on earth can you put, into practice the rule of the working class and move towards a situation of abundance in a country like Russia, which had, the same sort of level of economic development in 1917 as Cromwellian England.
I think that, when we're talking about the overlaps or lack thereof between Islam and Marxism, the thing that springs to my mind is less so like the practical or implementation type situations, and more so the theoretical aspects. So I'm not sure if you're aware, but Islam has a system of redistribution referred to as zakat, one of the pillars of Islam, in fact, distributable to 8 different categories of people. And there are some very specific laws when it relates to zakat of redistribution. And classically, they would divide it on livestock and minerals and obviously gold and silver as well. And so what scholars have done today, and most people in the world do, is they say, well, since the people don't use gold and silver to buy and sell, they use money, fiat currency, and so on. So they effectively redistribute using people's wealth. But that's not to say that 2.5%, which is the figure of zakatable income per year, is the only thing that's subtracted. Because obviously, if you have livestock as well, if you're a farmer, or if you have minerals of some sort, so I think the Hanafi position you guys are here is anything that comes from, oh, you got a shafak, anything that comes from the ground is zakatable, right? Yeah. Anything that comes from the ground. So, yeah, so it's zakatable and so on, anything that comes from the ground. So things like that are redistribution aspects of Islam. And in fact, there is one thing which in the Quran it says, حَتَّى لَا تَكُونَ دُولَةً بَيْنَ الْأَغْنِيَ مِنْكُمْ. It's talking about war booty. But then it states, such that, and this is chapter 59 of the Quran, such that it does not become redistributed, i.e. the wealth, among the elites among you. This is the verse in the Quran. حَتَّى لَا تَكُونَ دُولَةً بَيْنَ الْأَغْنِيَ مِنْكُمْ. Now you might say, I say حَتَّى. كَيْ لَا يَكُونَ دُولَةً بَيْنَ الْأَغْنِيَ مِنْكُمْ. So that it doesn't become a redistribution among the elites of you. And interestingly, there's a discussion. I mean, someone will say, well, this is specific to war booty. But then there's another scholarly discussion, is العبرة بي خصوص اللفظ لا بي عموم اللفظ لا بي خصوص السبب, or the idea that if phrases come and they're generic in application, then even if the circumstances of revelation are specific, that this is a, if you like, objective of the Sharia, which Islam has come. So in other words, we can take from this ayah, and we can take from the idea of redistribution in Islam, we can take from all that, that one of Islam's maqasid, if you like, or objectives, is that wealth is not distributed among elites. Definitely, this is the Islamic stance. So we are definitely anti-capitalist. There's no doubt about that. We do believe in redistribution. We don't believe in a society where poor people should pardon? Yeah, I mean, but in maybe in the ways that, I mean, a pure, libertarian maybe would not accept that. Yeah. So on that level, you can make it compatible with a kind of capital, but certainly not the usury. And this is another thing as well. I'm just offering additional maybe similarities and differences here, Jack. I'm not sure if you're... Are you still with us?
I wonder if you might be offering a little
Hello?
Your signal is pretty poor.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Can you hear me?
Yeah. So I was...
Follow your argument. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was just saying that in Islam, there are aspects of redistribution, and this is a point of intersection between Islam and, if you like, left-wing ideology, not just... left-wing economic ideology, like fiscal left-wing policies. So there's that. And there's also, which is a big thing, and I think rightly one of the participants wants me to ask you a question on this. Islam bans usury, interest. So it's obviously nowadays in banking and so on, the entire economy is practically predicated on interest rates and banking, the banking system. In fact, there is one prophecy of the Prophet Muhammad whereby he stated that there will come a time where usury will become so widespread, in lam ta'kulhu, if you don't consume it, asabathu, or man lam ya'kulhu asabathu min ghubari, whoever does not consume it, they will not be able to wipe off the dust of interest from them. So in other words, interest will be so widespread that it's almost it's inescapable from the human condition. This is a prophetic saying. There will be a time where interest will be so widespread where you will not be able to remove it from the human condition. So Islam has very, very, very staunch stance against interest. Interest is one of the seven major mubiqats, major sins in Islam. I mean, there are more than seven, according to the majority of scholars, but one of the seven most emphasized major sins. Interest is, I don't want to narrate them, but there are hadiths which are pretty severe about, I'm not sure, maybe for Jack, maybe later actually, you know, it might not be. But, you know, there are some, you know, prophetic sayings in Islam which are very anti-interest. In the Quran, in fact, then will be harbin min Allah wa Rasulih. That whoever consumes interest, then prepare for a war between Allah and His Messenger. الَّذِينَ يَأْكُلُونَ الرِّبَى لَا يَقُومُونَ إِلَّا كَمَا يَقُولَ الَّذِي يَتَخَبَّطُهُ الشَّيْطَانُ مِنَ الْمَسِ. That those who consume interest will not raise on the Day of Judgment except for the one who's basically been played around with by the devil or touched by the devil and so on. So the point is we have a very strong stance, anti-capitalist from that perspective, because modern-day capitalism, a lot of it is characterized by the interest systems. And from that perspective, Islam is anti-capitalist or anti-modern-day capitalist systems. And obviously with the redistribution aspect as well. So these are intersections. But the major, I think, point of dissimilarity is a hadith which can be found, which is authentic, where the Prophet said that, where they were actually asking him to stabilize the market, the prices for goods, and the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he stated that Allah or God is the musa'ir. He is the one who sets the price. Meaning, if you like, not the invisible hand of the economy. We're not using that language, but the idea is really that God was going to take care of that. And there are, on the face of it, verses of the Quran which seem to indicate that inequality of outcome is not something we're opting for, but is allowed to exist. And let me explain where. In the Quran it says, وَجَعَلْنَا بَعْضُكُمْ فَوْقَ بَعْضٍ دَرَجَاتٍ لِيَتَّخِذَ بَعْضُكُمْ بَعْضًا سِخْرِيَةً أَوْ سُخْرِيَةً. There's two qiraats. That we have allowed some of you to be above others, so that some of you can basically use others, well, not use others, but how would you do it? How would someone? Sukhriya, would you say is. No, not in this context. In this context, it would be not mockery now. It would be like utility.
Take advantage.
No, not advantage. No, it would be utility. It would be utility. So in other words, Islamically, the idea of an employer contract is not necessarily seen as exploitative by nature. In the same way that like, you know, Marx would say surplus value and all the stuff we covered before. So I think these are the aspects of dissimilarity. But there are aspects of similarity, as you've mentioned. These are just some technical details. Is there anything that you want to add, or Jack, about that?
Okay.
Yeah.
First of all, I would guess that most societies historically have involved some degree of redistribution downwards, simply because extremes of wealth lead to mass starvation, for example, in periods of crop failure. So there has to be some provision for emergencies or drought or whatever it happens to be. Okay.
Yep. There is,
so in
yeah.
In terms of Marxism, what we would be emphasizing is not so much circulation, redistribution, but production itself.
Yes.
So in terms of Marxism, the stress is, it's not ignoring distribution, but the stress is on production itself. And from our point of view, of course, although wages and prices, you know, are set anarchically, nonetheless, in our view, they revolve around value. And our search is not for a just price or a just wage, because we think that with prices, with wages, that still involves exploitation.
Yes.
And therefore, what we're emphasising is that the working class, the productive class in society, takes over the means of production and goes towards a system that's based on need,
mm-hmm.
not on greed, but on the basis that people are different and people have different needs. And it's also based on an assumption, and that might be a leap of faith, but I think I could argue why. But it's also based on people contributing according to their ability, hence the famous slogan of each according to their need, each according to their ability.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, there are crossovers, as you were saying. Nonetheless, there's clearly also distinct differences, because we don't think that there can be such a thing as a fair day's work for a fair day's pay. Of course, we're not saying that the capitalist cheats the worker. They do give them, on average, a fair wage, but within that relationship, there's exploitation. It's hidden. In a way that it isn't with slavery or it isn't with feudalism, but there is exploitation, and ultimately that comes back to labour and nature. Capitalism exploits labour power and it exploits nature.
Yeah, I think, you know, I was thinking about this myself, Jack, and I think a lot of the reason why Marx came to this conclusion, I don't think he's necessarily, within his own paradigm, inconsistent, actually, to be fair, having read him myself. I think within his own paradigm, he's not inconsistent. And when I say his own paradigm, I'm talking specifically about the materialist paradigm. Because I think the major difference in the Islamic understanding, for example, or any other understanding which has, I would say, latent or overt, you know, metaphysical traits, any such paradigm with overt metaphysical traits, there's going to be differences. And the differences here is relating to the eschatological paradigm. So from the Islamic position, this world that we're living in here, okay, the dunya, if you like, there is no prerequisite for everyone in this world to be equal in society. And when we say equality here, we mean in wealth. We mean in some people are going to be more clever than others, geographically located in places which are more advantageous than others. Some people are going to have better education than others. Some people are going to be born with disability and others are not. Some people, and that we don't think is inherently an injustice. Likewise, we don't think that some people employing others is inherently an injustice because of the surplus value that their work has put onto whatever object that they're creating, whatever product that they're making. We think that that's just a state of affairs which has been allowed to happen. But what we do say is, for those who act proper in this world, in a certain, within religious paradigms, that they will be rewarded in the next life. I mean, we have a narration, I'm not sure if you guys have come across it, which says that even animals, in this case I think it was a goat with a horn, a goat with a horn on the Day of Judgment, another goat without a horn, the goat with the horn, it hurts the goat with the horn, and the one without the horn will grow a horn and will hurt back the the Day of Judgment. The idea of the Day of Judgment means that perfect judgment will be administered, meted out on that forum, which is the forum of the Day of Judgment. So anything that happens here which may be exploitative, in this case we don't believe that the employee relationship is exploitative anyway, but we even things whereby people have been wronged within our own paradigm, it will be kind of rectified on the Day of Judgment. So that's, I think, really, unless we believe in that, if one believes in that, then it follows that, you know, it can't be that the rules of God, the prescribed rules of God, are unjust. But if one doesn't believe in that, and they believe in historical materialism as a basis, or has a secular understanding, that I don't see, I can see fully why someone would not believe in any of this. I fully understand the communist position. In fact, I'm sympathetic towards it from within its own paradigm. I understand it. I'm not saying it's even inconsistent within its own paradigm. But like you said, I think there are some assumptions which are a leap of faith. And I think that's where the major differences will have to continue being. What I was going to say next, though, just changing the subject actually a little bit, because I think we've done a good job here in fleshing out the main similarities and differences between communism and Islam, unless someone wants to add something here. Yep, someone wants to add something? Yep.
There's the market. You can ask about the free markets. I was going to say more about, you know, the things that we're talking about communism. But, I mean, the idea of the possibility of shirking your duties,
yes,
knowing that essentially the state is going to take care of you,
yes,
is also problematic, because we have, like, you know, خير المفروض والمفروض بعد المفروضات. You know, the Prophet ﷺ really encouraged people to go out and get a job to work. And I'm not saying that the communists are not saying that, but I'm just saying that the kind of idea that, well, it's okay if some people are not doing well, because there's an element of that redistribution is almost too central. And I think, you know, as a Muslim, you know, we're encouraged to basically get up and to do something. So for us, amal or practice is really important. And I think that as a psychology is very important, because it reflects us within the animal kingdom. The idea that we have to make our own space, the idea that we have to... So I think if we're looking at it biologically, if we're looking at it psychologically...
The worst way to acquire money is to seek it from others.
The upper hand is better.
Yeah,
than the
exactly.
Lower hand,
yeah. So I think, you know, from our paradigm, it's quite clear that we do have an aspect of free market. We encourage definitely trade. You know, Sayyidina Uthman, for example, the Prophet's son-in-law was very wealthy, etc. But even if we didn't look at it from our paradigm, even if you were just looking at it without this paradigm, I still think that it would cause it. It doesn't reflect you as a human being. I think biologically and psychologically, it doesn't reflect that, you know. And that's just my.
I'm not sure if you heard all that, Jack. Do you want to come back and say anything, respond to it? Anything?
I followed enough, but the connection here is poor. But yeah, I followed enough. Okay, just a couple of remarks. First of all, from my point of view, not just a sort of point of view, but historically. The fact that human beings have to sell themselves, have to sell their ability to labour, is a product of history. It's not something that is imposed on us by nature. It comes into being at a definite point in history. Marx defined capitalism as commodity production taken to the point of where labour itself generally appears as a commodity. So in ancient Greece, labor didn't generally appear as a commodity. You know, in ancient Arabia, labor didn't generally appear as a commodity. And so Marx in Capital actually tries to go back to the origins of this, and he talks about separation of the producer from the means of production. And in England, that happens at a definite moment, the enclosures, forcible removal of the labourers from the land. And therefore, they are left with nothing else available to them to make a living, to survive, other than selling themselves. So this isn't about human nature. And the second point, the final point I'll make, is that we've got very good anthropological studies that go back to what we think are the origins of our species, roughly speaking, 200,000 years ago, of where no classes existed. Of where, if you talk about this freeloader question, we can look at contemporary, what we would call original communist or primitive communist societies, of where, believe it or not, the freeloader, and they do exist, is regarded more as a joke than a threat. Now, obviously, if you generalized it, you die out. Nonetheless, what I would argue is, in terms of human nature, you know, we survived and thrived for 200,000 years without exploitation, without classes, without the state. And the Marxist project is to go back to what we would call our true nature, but on a higher material level. Hence our view of capitalism, in that sense, providing the material foundations for what we would call advanced or modern communism.
I guess I've got one thing to say, and then one of the participants wants to ask a question as well, but before he does, I just want to just make one comment. And I think you've kind of alluded to it already with this idea of, like, surplus value. You didn't mention it, but you mentioned it in another way. I'll give one example, like, of this brush here, which is, I use it to comb my beard so I can look more like Marx, but a good looking version of you know, but what I was going to say was, say for instance that this is the materials that are required for this kind of brush is like £1. Okay, so the material. Now, I assemble it together, and my job is to put these bristles in here, and then this is sold then thereafter that for £1, £5.50. Let's say £2 for the sake of that, or whatever you want. Yeah, sent for £1.99, £2. Yeah. Now, so correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just going to tell you my understanding of surplus value, and you tell me if I... So basically, obviously, after all the kind of costs have been paid, that surplus whereby I now, after the profits have been made even, yeah? The surplus is my work. I have put... It's like you said, you mentioned it, it's almost has become a commodity in itself. So my constructing these bristles onto this brush is the commodity here, which is now being given or transferred, and on the Marxist paradigm, exploitatively taken, right, from me to the owner of production. Is that so far so good, right? Or is there any
yep,
point?
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, good.
No, that's fine.
Fine. So at this point, there's a few issues here. Issue number one, say, for example, I have this young man, the strapping young man in the front. You can't see him, but say he is the owner of the company. And because he's such a strapping young man, and he's got charisma, and he's very confident, and he's been attending these sessions, so he's very intelligent as well. And so he's produced a brand name, which, just like Ralph Lauren or Rolex or any of these kind of names, means that that the end user, the consumer, will be willing to pay more for the same material cost. So, for example, if I had someone else, another factory, where someone else was producing exactly the same brush, okay, with the same exact composite parts, but for a much more expensive price, $9.99, not $1.99, then who gets the credit? This is the question. Who should get the credit for the fact that profits, or larger profits, have been made? Should it be this entrepreneur, this young, strapping, and charismatic, and confident entrepreneur in the front, you know? Or should it be me, because I've assembled it together? Because if it was a matter of well, me, because I've assembled it and put it together and it's a hidden commodity. Then ceteris paribus, everywhere where the same materials are found and the same composite things are there, then it should be the same cost. The assumption, therefore, that it's the same cost for every, that labor costs the same everywhere, especially in modern societies where it's driven by demand and supply, is seemingly a false assumption. What would you say to that?
Well, first of all, yes, that would be a false assumption. Indeed, it would be, at risk. It would be stupid. And Marx wasn't that stupid. So what his assumption is that price and value will diverge. And some products, some commodities will sell above their value, some will sell below. But on average, that will work itself out over billions and billions of commodity exchanges. So hence the assumption of life. It's, how should I put it, a working hypothesis, which I think can be supported, because, if you take your standard capitalist economics, they have a big problem in describing where profit comes from.
Okay. But so can I come back on one point? Sorry to cut you off.
Of course. No, it's all right.
I don't know if you've seen the date just watch, the Rolex, or they date watch. They're very good-looking watches. Now, if you try and buy them, the starting price is about £4,700. Don't ask me why. I know. Not that I've, trying to invest in anything like that myself. But I know this. I actually had a conversation with somebody recently that he has a day-date watch, classic, £20,000 it's worth. Well, this is the point. How do we know what it's worth? And this question, obviously, the modern assumption of free market economics is that value is determined by demand and supply. Now, the problem here, of course, is if we say that it's, because you mentioned above their value and below their value, but their value is itself determined by demand and supply. So how can it be above a value which is yet to be determined by the demand and supply? Can you see where? Can you see the cyclical nature of saying above and beyond it? Yeah. You see the issue? How would you resolve that?
Well, first of all, I would reject the idea that value is determined by demand and supply.
Okay.
That's the first thing.
Okay.
What I would do is go back to your original assumption, and that is to say that value is determined by inputs. And therefore the inputs are the hairs on the brush, the wooden bit, but also the labor power that you have put in to transforming those products. And again, the Marxist assumption on average is that you will be paid the value of your labor power, i.e. what is necessary for you to reproduce yourself and reproduce labor power in terms of a future generation. So that's the Marxist argument, not supply and demand. Of course, we don't
by input.
That,
can you explain value. That a little bit more then? So when you say value is determined by input, So let's flesh this out just a little bit more. Can you just explain that just as a standalone? First of all, what do you mean by that exactly? So I can write it down.
Well, what we're talking about is Marx begins in Capital with defining a commodity.
Yeah.
He says on the one side it's got use value.
Yep.
And on the other side, it's got exchange value. So when Marx talks about value, in the main, he's talking about exchange value. And that's determined by the market. Are you prepared to buy?
So we're talking about demand supply with that.
Well, okay. Nonetheless, we're still not talking about what determines its value. Because a commodity, right, might have a high value, but be forced by competition to sell below its value.
But then, would that mean that the value intrinsically changes, or does it stay the same, or what happens to the value?
The value will change according to the inputs. But what we're talking about here is the question of realization. And so, some capitalists, because of clever marketing, or because they're exploiting their workers with high technology, or whatever the reason happens to be, will realize the value of that commodity, and they can realize extra value. And therefore, some capitalists will not realize that value and either operate at a very low level of profit or be forced out of business. So we have a difference between value and realization.
But do you know when you said that a value, it changes according to its inputs, right?
Yeah.
So say, for example, you have a commodity, right? And it has a certain value, yeah? Now, as a standalone, without any input, first and foremost, let's just start with that. No one's touched it. A chunk of gold, a gold bar, just to you, is on the floor there somewhere. A Rolex watch, maybe. I don't know. Just watch. A chunk of gold bar. It's on the floor. What is the value of that chunk of, or that bar of gold? No one's touched it.
First of all, clearly, man, a bar of gold has been touched. I mean, by definition.
Okay. You got me there. An apple from the tree. Thank you. Yeah. An apple from the tree.
I'll put it on its feet. There is a nugget of gold on the ground.
Yeah, right, yeah.
A nugget of gold. You're walking along the road, or not, the, you know, the seashore.
An apple from the tree, like the brother said.
An apple.
Yeah.
Apple, for Marxism, has got no value. It's been supplied free by nature.
So has
it's
no
got
value.
No value.
Okay.
It's
great.
A product of nature with beautiful. No value.
So, what's its use value?
An apple. It's got loads of use value. You can eat it. So, that's why we're defining a commodity.
When you say it has no value, you're talking about exchange value? Or because you said, remember, we said that value is exchange and use.
You can pick it up and you can eat it. Unless you're...
Is it valuable? Is it... When you say no value...
It's got value, it's got use value.
Okay, it has use value.
Unless you take it to the market, it's got no exchange value and therefore no value. But yeah, we all like apples.
Okay,
so
but...
It's got use value.
I seem to be... I might be, you know, maybe misreading what you're saying, and please correct me if I'm wrong. But it seems to be a cyclical argument, and I'll tell you why. Because if we say that the value of something is determined by the input, which is what you said, a value is according to its input, yeah. And if I ask you, how do you prove that a value of something is according to its input?
Okay.
Then you go back to saying that, because it doesn't have any value until the input has been put into it, then it becomes, if you put it in that articulation, in that formulation, that the value of something is according to its inputs, and then we say, okay, fine, how do you prove that the value of something is according to its inputs, and it's not just demand and supply, which is the normative understanding, then you say, well, I'm not saying you've said this, but obviously you're at danger of making this argument, is that, well, the value of something, because something has no value until an input has been touched. So if the evidence for that, the value of something is according to its input, the fact that it has no value before it's been touched, then it's a cyclical argument, because you're using the input to prove the input. Do you see what I'm saying here?
Okay, yeah, I don't agree with you. First of all, I'd make the point that Marx he didn't invent the labour theory of value. I mean, you can read Aristotle, he's, you know, vaguely making remarks along those lines. But in terms of its height, which I think Marx goes one better, it's people like David Ricardo and Adam Smith.
Yeah.
And so what we're arguing about... It isn't going along the road and finding a nugget of gold. What we're talking about is a society that is characterized by human beings interacting with nature on a generalized level. So, of course, we get things for free from nature. So sunshine, I find that very useful. We couldn't survive without sunshine. The air that I breathe. Well, at the moment, they haven't managed to turn that into a commodity. It's got use value. Without it, I cannot live, right? Mm-hmm. So, of course, you know, there could well be, given pollution and all that, an attempt to ration us or something like that. But, yeah, Marxism is dealing with the commodity, which isn't the same as a product, and isn't the same simply as something that comes free from nature. It's something that comes from relationships between human beings that has a history, that has a prehistory and has a more recent history. So I don't think it's a circular argument.
Right. So if,
and I'll just finish with this.
Yeah, of course.
If I could.
Of course.
It's just taking your gold as an example. Now, it's true that in Namibia, as I understand it, or parts of South Africa, you can walk along, you know, the desert and find a piece of gold. That's absolutely right.
Mm.
But we also know that in South Africa, tens of thousands of people are put to work to extract gold.
Okay.
And that determines the price and the value of gold. I'm not saying the two are exactly the same, but precisely because they have to dig deep and they have to employ so many thousands of workers, that's what gives it value. Gold can be a useful metal, but what gives it its price, its value, in terms of being a tiny little nugget, is the amount of labor, ultimately. Yeah, machinery, but I'd say that that is crystallized labor from the past. So it's labor, labor, labor. Plus nature, of course.
Okay, so I guess if it's not circular, let me ask you this question then.
Hmm.
If a value changes according to its inputs, which is what you said, how do you prove that a value changes according to its inputs in a sense without saying that without stating that because had it not had an input that the value would change, which would be the circular argument. So how do you prove this premise, which is a value changes according to its inputs, without employing the circular argument of saying that without the input the value wouldn't change?
Well, from my knowledge of standard economics, and, I didn't study it at university, but what you've got is the idea of various inputs going into what I would call a commodity. So classically, it's land, where you have your factory or you have your agriculture, it's raw materials, and it's labor. And I think the interesting thing for people new to Marxism, and I have to include myself at some point,
it's very humble of you being a leader of the party.
People can't see me, but I've got grey hair now.
Well, that makes two of us.
No, the point I would make is it seems paradoxical that some of the things we're surrounded by have actually got very low value. Right, and if we look at previous versions of it, or versions that are maybe made in less advanced societies, actually they've got a higher value. And yet, precisely, this is the point about Marx: is he says, "Okay, so you've got high value, low value. Who realizes the profit? Who realizes that surplus value?" And it isn't that I produce a commodity with a high value, and therefore I make a fat profit, because I might have to sell it at a high price. And if I have to sell it at a high price, some other capitalist is going to realize that surplus value. So the job of a capitalist is to drive down the value of that commodity. That doesn't mean that his profits or her profits go down necessarily, but in terms of for each unit, it's got less inputs into it, crucially labor. I mean, we all know about automation. We all know about machinery. You know, what used to take a day can be done in minutes, seconds, often nowadays.
Mm. Okay, well, that's very informative. I don't want to take too much more of your time. I want to ask you just two more questions and see, and then round it up. people are aware of what Marxism is, I think, now, based on the aforementioned conversation. But what would you say are the differences between Marxism, communism, socialism and social democracy? What, generally speaking, are the main areas of demarcation?
Well, first of all, it's a bit of a funny one, because I think, I'm not quite sure, but certainly in terms of classic Marxism, people like Lenin, the contemporaries of Marx, Marx's comrades in Germany, they called themselves social democrats.
Okay.
So the first name of Russia, Lenin's party, was the Russian Social Democratic Labour Party.
Mm.
In 1914, that changed because World War I and most leaders of social democracy supported the war. And Lenin said, well, we can't call ourselves social democrats anymore. Hence the going back to the word that Marx had originally used to describe himself back in the Communist Manifesto, I'm a communist.
Right.
So if we now take at least my use of the word socialism, it simply means the transition period between capitalism and communism. It's a state, semi-state, but it's the transition from capitalist society bearing all its imperfections to communism, which is about production for need, people working according to their ability. So that's a very short answer with all sorts of stuff left out. But it's one of these paradoxes. It shows you how words change.
Finally, I want to talk about, I just ask you one last question. I know I've taken up lots of your time, and I think everyone here is very grateful for your time.
I enjoyed it.
We have as well.
Very stimulating,
We'll give questions at the end, yeah? But one more question from me. It's just about the Uyghur situation. As you know, because there's a small Muslim minority in East Turkestan of persecuted individuals, and obviously China refers to itself as the Chinese Communist Party, or the governing party in China refers to itself in those terms. What do you think the position is, or what would Marx's position be himself, or your position even on the kind of things that are happening in the area?
It's very difficult because we're in a situation of a new Cold War, and therefore when I read American sources, British sources, my own instant response is that true? So I'm not convinced about the idea of genocide. I'm certainly convinced about the idea of oppression and exploitation. To me, when I look at the Chinese Communist Party, what you've got is something that's turned into its opposite. When it was founded in 1921, they clearly had different goals than compared with what they've now got. Either way, you asked me about what Marx would have thought, and I think he would have been appalled that people are carrying out national oppression in the name of Marxism and communism. But the problem that people like myself has got is, do I carry on calling myself a communist, or do I want to call myself something else? I've already illustrated Lenin in 1914 saying, I don't want to call myself a social democrat anymore. It's a decision that I've made personally, that I want to continue calling myself a communist and yet point the finger at the Communist Party of the Soviet Union under Stalin and his successors and Xi and Mao. And my argument is, well, they're not communists. They call themselves communists. Well, that's a problem for me. But I think, again, one thing that comes to my mind, and I think it was from Lenin, and he said, well, the problem that we've got, and Matt's calling social democrats, communists, socialists, is that we called ourselves the party of pink angels. Our enemies would turn pink angels into the devil. So we can call ourselves whatever we want. I would say that my approach to the world, it's got a lot more in common with Karl Marx, Lenin, and all the rest of it than Xi, Mao, Stalin, let alone, Enver Hoxha or Pol Pot. To me, these are freaks, abominations. They have something to do with Marxism in terms of what names and what words they use, but nothing in reality to do with Marxism.
Any other questions from the floor before we conclude with Jack? And thank you once again, Jack, for your time. Any questions on the floor?
I just wanted to make a few points in response. Number one was this idea you mentioned of the enclosures. So this is a very famous moment where some people would claim that British capitalism began with the enclosures, with the peasants and their lands being enclosed and used in order to farm for profit. And then obviously you have this idea of the Industrial Revolution and things, but if Marx's theory is predicated on those two things, that's a very Eurocentric response. That's Marx's ideas then are built in response to something that happened very specific in Europe. So Marxism then would be a very specifically European phenomenon and would work. And even his predictions in terms of a European context, I mean, you mentioned advanced capitalist societies is what Marx thought, where that's what he thought where the revolution would begin. He was very wrong, because in Germany and Britain, where he thought the revolution would begin, it didn't. It began in Russia, which was, like you mentioned yourself, and you said it was, in terms of economic development, it was akin to Cromwell's England. Which is, again, Marx's predictions. As somebody who claimed to be a scientist making predictions, historical materialism, he came out to be very incorrect in the predictions that he made. And obviously the fact that it's so Eurocentric makes his universability not practical. And I think in terms of the Islamic system, I think one of the big problems I think Muslims would have is this idea, one of the core things about Marxism is this idea of alienation. And this is taken from Hegel.
Can you define it, please, before you continue?
Yeah. Alienation is this idea that you have been, how would you put it? I think in Islam we'd call it la wahsha, to be spiritually lost, to be in the wrong place, to be sort of this. It's just like a very sort of moral, psychological, spiritual state where somebody's not in the place that they're meant to be. And Marx would say that's because the worker has been alienated from the means of production. And the Muslim would have a lot of problems with that, because that's a very religious concept put in materialistic terms, and that's a very secular idea. And I think in the Islamic system we have this idea of, and then obviously this idea that you're trying to rebuild. For example, if we talk about the Islamic system, we have markets, but there's an ethical religious framework in which these markets are embedded. If you remember, I don't know if you've read Karl Polanyi, but what Polanyi talks about embeddedness, that you have markets embedded in religious societies or non-religious societies, but this idea of moral markets. And this is where you would have that, even though people are rich, because if you have this idea people produce for need, then you have the great conundrum that the loads of communist societies in the 20th century did, in that people stop producing, production doesn't happen, or production happens, for example, with the Chinese in Mao, is this idea that let's pretend to the state that production is happening, and when finally they allowed people to actually build on their own little plantations, that's when growth actually started to happen, because people are incentivized to produce when it's for at least some sort of selfish idea. And before Adam Smith mentioned this, because you mentioned this idea of this, the Arab world didn't have this idea. I mean, Dave Graeber, who is a brilliant anthropologist at the LSE, who died last year, actually, my dream was to meet him, I never got to, in his book, The First 5,000 Years, he mentions that before Adam Smith, Hujjatul Islam, Imam al-Ghazali, rahmatullah alayhi, has this idea of, you know, this division of labor, and the idea that, for example, what Adam Smith would call the invisible hand was something envisaged by Muslim scholars long before him, based on a virtue ethicist sort of Islamic idea, like Mishkaway and Ibn Abi Dunya, and there's many, many other scholars who've written on this. So I just think that what we have as an Islamic platform is a much better and more practical, realistic way of organizing society, understanding, because what Marxism does is removes religion, and religion is that which allows the altruism within people to manifest itself. I could go on and on and on, but I'm just thinking, like, you think about the Ottoman Empire, the waqf that you have on every single, the hospitals that the rich people would set up, the waqf, the idea of the endowment that rich people in Islamic societies, they would not be there to exploit. They would have this idea that is my religious obligation to take care of the poor. Hence, I will now fund, whether that's the sultan or his female family members or the wazir or whoever, would set up the hospitals, they would set up schools, they would set up the mosques. And the mosques would be built with a market directly next to it to fund the mosque, because they understood. And I just feel like, I don't know if I'm making any coherent points here, but I think for me, Marxism becomes very antithetical to the historical reality that Islam has ever seen. Because we've always had this idea that religion is the core, and for Islam, and I think, and I'll finish with this, is this idea that for Muslims specifically, to especially with the history we've had with colonialism, to remove the yoke of European exploitation from our necks, and then to take another European idea that has no sort of organic production with our own community, is just a farce. I think we're very happy that we have a tradition that we can go back to, ideas that Marx spoke about, better, cleverer people, I would say, without a shadow of it, a more moral people, because Marx cheated on his wife and he wasn't a good person, but he was an immoral person. Engels' father ran a sweatshop, and Marx was funded from Engels, so while he was complaining about capitalism, it was the sweatshop that, or whatever, the factory that Engels' father used to run, would fund Marx's works. And I think that Muslims would be very, very uncomfortable with Marx's idea. I'm not a capitalist, but I'm just saying that I think we have our own frameworks, our own ideas, and our own tradition that we can go back to rather than moving to Marxism.
Well, I think that deserved the camera being on your direction. But Jack, any last comments on that? Would you want to end it there?
Well, I'd like to come back, but you're going to have to shut me up very quickly because okay. There's so much there. That was a really not great question, but a great series of questions.
Yep.
So I'm going to try
okay.
just to yep. say a few things. First of all, accusation that Marx was Eurocentric. I think that's profoundly wrong. Of course, he began studying capitalism where it first made its major breakthrough and made that point countless times, and also made the point that the rest of the world doesn't need to follow England. And indeed, you know, what's interesting about Marx is not only his writings on China and India, but in the last years of his life, he stopped writing Capital in order to teach himself Russian, in order to study the Mir, the commune of the peasants in Russia, and, you know, wrote, whether rightly or wrongly, about the possibility of Russia actually avoiding capitalist development. So, Eurocentric, no. And also in terms of this whole thing, well, what we've got in terms of Engels is a book called The Origin of the Family, Private Property and the State. And what that bases itself on is the Neolithic revolution, what I would call a counter-revolution. It's hardly happened in Europe. We know that now, definitely. So, again, I would say, no, not Eurocentric. Lastly, and, you know, I think I've, you know, said enough. Lastly, on Marx's prediction. Well, precisely, in the last preface to the Communist Manifesto that Marx and Engels jointly wrote, which I think was 1882, a year before his death, they're actually predicting that the revolution will first happen in Russia. And they say that unless the revolution happens in the rest of Europe, there will be a disaster, there will be barbarism, there will be war. So I'm not claiming that if you look at Marx, you can find, there he did, he predicted what's happening with us now in the 21st century. But he had a pretty powerful tool available to him to analyze the contemporary politics of his day, and to project what is human, the future for humanity. Lastly, altruism. This is me speaking as a absolute atheist. Now, I respect Muslims. I respect people who are religious. And what I would tell you is that some of the most altruistic, most humane people I've ever met in my life are atheists. So I just think that as well as me respecting religious people who can be altruistic, you know, I've given my life for the struggle. I know lots of other people, you know, around the world, you know, communists who fought, maybe wrongly, you might disagree with them, but they've certainly not done what they've done for selfish purposes.
Well, I mean, we've got an entire session, in fact, on egoism and altruism.
Okay.
Which we've completed. It should be coming up after this one. But Jack, I think it's been a pleasure having you here. And honestly, the contributions of the group have been very good as well. You're always welcome to come as an atheist to visit us here in the office. You know how to get through to us, and or we can get something to eat as well. Maybe somewhere in North London near Marx's grave, so you can do your. but where is he buried again, Jack?
Highgate Cemetery. I live in Hampstead, so
okay.
I'm next door.
Fair enough. Well, Jack, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much. I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you so much for your time. I'll see you later.
Yeah.
Bye. And that concludes our session today. Some very fantastic contributions from our very special participants. I feel like I should have been on this side of the camera on many occasions this time, and hopefully I will be on this side of the camera, and those on the other side will take a leading role. This is the whole point of the Sapiens Institute, series, The Londoner. And with that, we conclude. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.